climbing his firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut. Quantel, opt-in, opt-in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Well, greetings to you all. It is Saturday once again, the 7th of January in the glorious future year of 2024. That's wrong. It's the 6th. Why did I say it was the 7th? Because being confidently wrong is my prerogative as an American. Well, and so having made a strong start to the year already, what do I have to talk to you about today? Well, I thought I'd go back just for a moment to a topic that I addressed last time, which is robustness. And of course, this is a hobby horse of me. People talk about robustness and resilience, and they talk about climate adaptation and this, that, and the other thing. And sometimes I think that they don't stop to think. What inspired this? Well, a couple of examples of lack of robustness that I encountered while running errands yesterday, to be perfectly honest. So they have fairly recently started a diesel light rail, is the best way I can describe it, line, that runs between Fort Worth, Texas, downtown Fort Worth, Texas, and the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Dallas has its own electrified rail line, which has been in service rather longer and runs between downtown Dallas and the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. But that's not important. What's important is that there are stops along this line, and at some of them, the local authorities have tried to do some development, thinking, oh, hey, you know, people are going to be stopping here and we can have a, you know, commercial center or what have you in this area, which is sort of a good idea, right? Anyway, and in Grapevine, Texas, there is Grapevine Main Street Station. And Grapevine is a town where they have tried to have a bunch of kitschy little tourist trap-like shops and things like that. Sort of a nostalgia downtown to paper over the fact that the rest of Grapevine is just more strip malls and fuel oil storage tanks, the way that it is all over the area. Anyhow, but at the stop in Grapevine, which they grandiosely call Grapevine Main Street Station, they've erected a grandiose red brick building that looks somewhat like a railway station from a city in the 19th century. And one of the things that occupies the ground floor public accessible space is a series of what they refer to as a European-style food hall. In other words, you go in and there are seating areas and then there are kiosks where you can buy different kinds of food. There's a sushi one and a barbecue one and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Well, I went in, I circulated around, I stopped at one of the booths because they had something that I liked the look of, and I said, well, I'll have this, and the person said, oh, that's great, it'll be such and so, and I pulled out my wallet and began pulling out cash. He said, oh, no, we don't accept cash here, only cards. Well, or Apple Pay or whatever else the hell, right? But we don't, of course we don't accept cash here, and I said, well, I'm sorry, you've lost a sale, and walked out, right? And the same happened to me, I mean, In fall, I think, of 2020 at Kinokuniya, which is a Japanese bookstore in Carrollton, Texas. And that I could understand as, you know, oh, well, there's a pandemic going on. You don't want to handle cash. You've got the cashier glassed in and all that. Fine. But in a food hall where nobody's wearing masks, right, where there's no plexiglass barrier between you and the cashier, whatever. No, they just decided that they were only going, they were not going to handle cash. Well, and this got to me a little. I mean, basically, if you're doing counter sales and you don't accept cash, I'm probably not going to deal with you, right? You've lost a sale from me. Whatever it is, I'm not going to buy it. But it really struck me that cash, one of the advantages of cash, right, it works even if there's a blackout, right, even if the power's gone out. It works in a thunderstorm. It works even when half the internet connections in your country are out of service because of a misconfigured server somewhere, as happened in Australia a few days ago. Half of all the telecoms, because of course these days it's VoIP everywhere, so if the internet goes out, your phone also goes out, right? Half of all the telecom in Australia was down for hours because of a misconfiguration somewhere. And I don't know about anyone else, right? But it strikes me that whatever inconveniences are attendant to handling cash, it is nevertheless extremely robust. And that is a virtue which should not be like lightly passed over or easily given up. A second money-related thing that occurred that had me drawing the same conclusion. So my credit union sent around a notice last year saying, we're changing a fee schedule. There's now going to be a $3 a month fee for paper statements. Well, I didn't like this very much because with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau cracking down on fees charged by commercial banks, I really thought it doesn't look good when my credit union is increasing and adding fees. I don't like this at all, right? But they said, you've got to sign up for e-statements by the end of the year. We're going to start charging you the fee. So, reluctantly, I went and signed up for e-statements. And then I checked my account this week, and lo and behold, they'd charged me the $3 fee. And, in fact, I even got a paper statement. You know, I went down to the bank and I said, look, what's going on here? And they said, well, in my system here, it shows that you didn't do the thing. You didn't sign up for e-statements. I said, I know that I signed up for e-statements. Look, here's one I printed out from home. Well, I don't know. Well, I'll refund you the fee, and if it happens again next month, you'll have to come in with your account credentials so you can log in from one of our computers here. Now, none of this seems like a particularly good idea, right? None of it seems like a particularly good idea. And also, again, from the point of view of robustness, if you're going to essentially require everyone to use something, don't you think it would be a good idea to make sure that it works first, right? Make sure that it's actually going to behave as advertised. There seems to be a decided lack of that particular kind of precaution going around. Before you insist that everybody use something, make sure it's actually going to work. I strongly suspect that I'm not the only one affected by this. Anyway, so there's that. But let's see, good news. Well, is it good news? I don't know if it's good news or not. I went out today and I spent some money to buy a thing. And you're thinking, oh no, you bought another thing. You're getting so full of things. You almost had a shelving unit collapse on you. Maybe you shouldn't buy any more things. But a thing I bought nevertheless. So what kind of a thing is it? Well, it's a moistener. And you say, a moistener. You mean like a spray bottle? No. No, it is a ceramic wheel with a little metal axle, which sits in a ceramic trough, and you fill the trough with water, and you roll the wheel, and the wheel picks up water, and then you use this to apply water to the flaps of envelopes and to the backs of postage stamps and other things that require moistening. Basically, it makes sending mail go faster. It's a piece of office equipment. And that's relevant, of course, because I have thousands of envelopes. I have hundreds of dollars in stamps, certainly not enough stamps to actually mail all the envelopes that I have, but I can get more stamps if I have money. And what this means, right, in a practical sense, is it increases my ability to send out mail. And of course, as I've already told you, I now have a monochrome laser printer. I have a long arm stapler, courtesy of MNW, DJ Marcus, who has this time slot Monday through Friday where he uses it to do a news show. Thank you very much, DJ Marcus. And I have a paper folding machine. And what all that means is that I can make booklets and leaflets and pamphlets and other kinds of publication material, and I can send them out. Now, I can send out mail. I can send it to you if you want it. Right. I'm going to remind you here, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And I dropped the address into COM just now, so you can see it if you're on the SDF Public Access Unix system. In fact, it should show up in the metadata of your media player even, which is pretty nifty. But as you're well aware, I'm doing advocacy efforts. I am, of course, always soliciting people to please send me money, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam, specifically if you think my advocacy efforts are worthwhile, so that I can do more of them, right? That's largely what the money is for, right? And so I'm telling you how I spend that money because I thought you might want to know. So yeah, here's the thing, right? I have recently been working on a little publication. It's a simple little booklet. Some of you who are listening have received a copy of a preliminary version. And the idea is to have something to put into, for example, these little free library book exchange boxes that are cropping up all over, so that people who are looking through the contents of the box might find it, might look at it, might say, well, that's interesting, and read it. Trying to understand what's going on in COM, and I think I've completely lost the thread of the plot. There's always commentary in COM, and sometimes it has to do with in the non-radio room, sometimes it has to do with what's being played or talked about on a non-radio, and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes I literally can't tell that there seem to be conversations going on that I can't find the thread of them. Anyway, but where was I at? Well, basically saying that when I look out at the world, I certainly see a lot of people spreading messages of doom and gloom. And as you know, certainly there's a lot of things in the world that are unsatisfactory, a lot of things that are going badly, a lot of people who are suffering needlessly, a lot of people who are being oppressed by other people, right? All these are bad things, and I'm not Pollyanna-ish about them, right? But I am saying that we can do better. And that is that's too vague, right? You say we can do better, people say, well, how? And so I try to provide some answers to that question of how. Because fundamentally, we can't just expect a better world to come along. And we can't just expect a better world on the basis of saying, well, this world could be better, right? There's a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon about that, you know, which Calvin's mom says, things could be a lot worse. And Calvin says, things could be a lot better, too. And yeah, they could. But you have to identify how they could be better. And you have to identify a path towards making them better. And we have, I think, a lot of social critics in the world today who, they never try to identify how things could be better, right? They're always interested in what's bad. They never try to identify how things could be better. They never try to identify a path towards things being better in that way. And often I don't think that they really care whether things get better or not. And if that sounds cynical, I come by it honestly. My mother's mother, now passed away some years, had this, well, there's a quote somewhere, you know, he's the evenest tempered man alive, angry all the time. Well, my grandmother, the only way I could describe her personality to people was by saying she's never happy unless she has something to complain about. So, you know, that's paradoxical as that might sound, I think it's a common characteristic in the human race. And it's also true that if you spend all your time identifying problems, you know, I mean, people say, well, you have the same solution to everything. And of course, I try to prove that I don't, in fact, have the same solution to everything. You should suspect people who always have the same solution to everything. But you should also suspect people who don't have solutions, but when they identify a problem, it's always the same problem. You know, you should suspect that, because there's a kind of mental involution that can occur, where you sort of spiral in, you know, ever-narrowing spirals of the mind. And, you know, what happens? I mean, for example, you know, I see people want to talk about racism. All right. The problem is, racism is a multi-valued problem. So, one aspect of it that people don't really want to face up to is that racism, as we know it today, is to a great extent a product of the Enlightenment. And what I mean by that, for example, if you think about slavery in the United States of America, which was intensely racialized and extremely brutal, and the slave owners, the big slave owners, they did not believe in any way, shape, or form in the spiritual unity of the white race. Okay? The fundamental concept which underlies racism, for example, in the way that the Nazis understood it, in the way that people who are ideologically committed to racism, and to a great extent, people who are ideologically committed to anti-racism, the way that they think about it, is this concept of Blut und Boden, blood and soil, the idea that there is, somehow there is the folk, the people, some kind of spiritual entity composed of human beings, all of whom share a common ancestry, a common language. They exclusively occupy a delimited territory, then they have, by long, continuous occupation, right, they have acculturated themselves to the soil and the soil to them, and they have a consistent and shared set of spiritual beliefs and ritual practices. And this is basically bullshit. I don't know where in the world you would find people who actually answer to that description. Maybe the closest would be the Haida people of the Queen Charlotte Islands in Canada. And it's certainly true that a lot of the very same ideas, the very same rhetoric, right, are being deployed in what the people deploying them consider a positive sense, right, on behalf of, quote, indigenous peoples or communities, right? They talk about them in exactly the same way that racists talk about their preferred race. But ultimately, it's all bullshit. That construct, you know, leaving aside the notion of spiritual unity, that construct of a shared ancestry, a shared language, a territory which is coterminous with the shared ancestry and the shared language, a system of governance and a system of ritual observances and a spirit, you know, spiritual beliefs that are all neatly delimited like that and are shared within this in-group and not with the rest of the world. That's bullshit. It doesn't exist. It never has existed. At best, it's a melange of approximations. You know, there have been some interesting studies of the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, for example. And it turns out, right, Aboriginal peoples of Australia have these really elaborate systems, which we sort of assume to be common to other semi-nomadic hunter-gatherer peoples. But most of those semi-nomadic hunter-gatherer peoples, they're either have disappeared or their lifestyles have changed enough. But there's that they're difficult to study with the tools of modern anthropology. But modern anthropologists are able to study some of these Aboriginal Australians. And they found something very interesting, which is although a particular band or a particular tribe or a particular group or nation may claim, for example, that they're all common descended from the sacred blue-tongued serpent. You know, obviously that's a fictitious claim, right? But it seems to imply, in a human sense, that they all share a common ancestry. It turns out this isn't true, that there'll be a moiety or a faction which, you know, they say, oh, well, we are the X, and we all have this in common. And anthropologists who've studied them have gotten to the point of sophistication of discovering, oh, like one in five people are either, they were born into a different band or moiety or totem within the same nation or tribal group, or in fact, they're not from there at all, that they left their home community and migrated sometimes hundreds of kilometers until they found a group that they fit in with somehow. And so there's actually a phenomenon of immigration and naturalization that's taking place within these communities that are, formally speaking, right, formally speaking, they claim to be this unity. I mean, in many cases, they, as research tends to show, there are folks who they didn't even speak the language, right? They've learned the language. They're not from the same cultural milieu at all. Which is, this is truly fascinating. And it reflects on the existence of what are known as bear and turtle moieties, which exist or existed in Native American groups, American Indians, from across vast swaths of the continent, and in tribal and national groups that often were at genocidal war with each other most of the time. You know, Apaches and Zunis and Hopis, you know, would not necessarily suffer the other group to live if they came in contact with them, but it appears very likely that there was this, and to some extent perhaps still is, but there was this mechanism where you might be born an Apache and you might spend your life as a Zuni, even though the Zunis and the Apaches killed each other without mercy when they met. This is fascinating, and it shows the hollowness of one of the constructs over which people are to this day, right now in places like Ukraine and Palestine, killing each other in large numbers. That this idea of the folk, this idea of the spiritual unity of the nation, not only does it refer to a thing that has no objective existence, because frankly, the government of the United States doesn't have an objective existence. There's a wonderful old anarchist pamphlet where someone says, you know, the president of the United States stands up on Capitol Hill and swears to enforce the laws and constitution of the United States. If I were to stand up on Boston Common and swear to enforce on the laws of people of Massachusetts, the laws of, to enforce on the people of Massachusetts, the laws of Moses or of Solon, either everyone would ignore me or they would put me in the loony bin. And so the author of the pamphlet asks, why, right, why should we treat one any different than the other? And I think the answer is that societies always require order, and the only way for order to exist in societies is by a form of common consent, either by explicit or by tacit consensus. And the nature, I think, of nationalism... Right, so the American, you're right, the United States is very much, at its founding, a social contract. The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, these come closest to the Enlightenment ideal of the social contract. The idea that we are Americans because we agree to observe these laws and occupy this territory in common. There is always a project of nationalism which tries to convert that explicit consensus into a tacit consensus. And my opinion about why that should be is at least in part that a tacit consensus is much more difficult to examine, much more difficult to ask, are people acting in accordance with it than an explicit consensus is. When you have an explicit consensus, when you have a constitution and laws and a series of standards which say, in order to be an American, you have to do X and Y and refrain from M and N, you can check. Right. Whereas if people are out there singing this ghastly song, which I first remember hearing on July 4th of 1986, and I, as a four-year-old, I hated it even then. I'm proud to be an American, or at least I know I'm free. You know, I hate this song. I despise it. I loathe it. It fills me with disgust. Because, to me, it represents, and I wouldn't have been able to articulate this at 4 years old, but never mind that, it represents moving from an explicit to a tacit consensus. And the nature of a tacit consensus is you can shift it. You can say, oh, well, that person has to be outcast because they're violating the tacit consensus. Right, you don't say that out loud, but you do certain things to imply it. This is the thing, a tacit consensus is never properly open to question, whereas an explicit consensus, right, the Constitution has modes of amending it. The Congress has the power of changing legislation. Rowley and Com saying that, yeah, he got quite a hard time from the folk in South Africa. That's a great example, honestly, of the Boers, as they're disparagingly known. Right, the Afrikaners, there is a section of their population, not the whole population, but who, you know, they just feel that they are entitled by God to rule the whole country and own all the property, and that nobody else should think that rights apply to them. Anyway, so this has been a lot of talk to perhaps very little purpose. But again, I want to invite you to send me mail, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I want to invite you to support me, patreon.com.